It's Greg Hughes on the 9 to Noon Show on Highland Radio.
Okay, we're joined on the program by Johanna, who stepped out of work to have a talk to us now. I do appreciate it, Johanna. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi.
Right, so Johanna, what is, your issue effectively is registering your vehicle. What's the background to the problem, though, Johanna?
Yeah, so I moved over to Donegal from the UK in September, and I've got a job in the civil service. I bought a vehicle 3 months before I moved, not knowing that if I'd had the vehicle for 6 months before I moved, I wouldn't have to go through the VRC process. So I got this vehicle, which I need because due to the housing crisis, I live quite remote from my job. I also, my role covers the whole of Donegal, so I need this vehicle. And I've been trying since October to get the thing registered. And every time I go back to the VRT place, they tell me that I have to go and get engineer's reports. And I've spent nearly €2,000 doing everything that they've asked me to do. And they just got back to me this week saying I need yet another engineer's report because it's a different classification of vehicle than it says on the logbook. And I'm just at the end of my tether. I've been trying to get this vehicle insured and taxed so that I can use it legally on the roads, but they just seem to be doing everything they can to stop me from doing that.
Yeah, and so you have spent more money trying to make this van compliant than it actually is worth, if the truth be told.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have a lot of money, so I couldn't be particularly picky about what vehicle I got. So I snapped this vehicle up when it came up for sale on private sale. So I couldn't be that choosy. I paid £4,000 for it. But with the customs as well, I've had to pay thousands for that, which is another saga in itself. And I just got to the point where the other day I went to the police station and I said, I need to report somebody for driving a vehicle, unregistered vehicle, illegally. What are you going to do about it? Because I've tried to be law-abiding. I've tried to do everything that they've asked, and they can't give me the logic behind it. They wouldn't tell me in advance how much it would cost. I've spent hours researching what I've got to do, what I'm going to have to pay.
Well, Johanna, someone else is bound to have gone through this. Okay, so. You moved from what you've been saying to us. It sounds like you moved from Britain to the Republic of Ireland. You bought a van and you moved over to Ireland with that van. Now, you have had the van only 3 months. Now, what...
Before moving here,
okay. And this is where... So you have to bring it in effectively. So you have to register it as a Republic of Ireland vehicle. So what have you...
Yeah.
What are they saying that you need to do now to make it compliant so that you can transfer it to an Irish number plate, I suppose?
So initially, I had to try and prove to customs that it was manufactured in the UK, and they were refusing to accept it, although it's a Vauxhall, and Vauxhall were only made in the UK at the time. Mm. So that was a huge palaver. I ended up phoning somebody in Dublin Ferryport and saying, you know, we've got to find a way around that, and then somebody was just having a good day and cleared it for me. Then I finally got to the VRT place, and initially they said to me that, and I can understand this, it's got a driver's seat and a passenger seat, and on the logbook it says it's got three seats, so it's got two passenger seats in the front cab. So they wanted an engineer's report to say that it was safe. I mean, so they couldn't tell me where I could get an engineer from to do this, because this isn't something I'm familiar with. So luckily, a mechanic that I've been fortunate enough to meet found somebody for me. I met them in the car park at work. I mean, it just feels so dodgy. I met them in the car park at work. They took pictures of the bolts on the seat. Like, charged me €200, wrote a report, did all the safety checks on it, said it's very well maintained, roadworthy, not a problem with it. I took those documents back to VRT as requested, only to be told that that's not good enough and I have to get another engineer's report because they're classing it as a camper van.
Right. This is not an articulated lorry here we're talking about. You know, this is a van.
It's a Vauxhall Vivero van, yeah.
Right.
So, ironically, it was an ex police speeding camera van, so it spent a lot of its life sitting by the side of the road.
Yeah. And then it's just sitting in the one place, taking money off
mileage,
people.
Well maintained. Yeah, well maintained.
So now they're set. So
they
so now
for their vehicles.
Once you've clarified the front of it, the seats and all that kind of malarkey, now they're saying that it is it a camper van? Is it not a camper? What are they actually? What just remind us again? What is the sticking point now?
So before I got it, the people that had it before had partly converted it. There's a bed in it,
yeah,
and they had a camping stove in it, and they'd. In 2021, they registered it as an N1 vehicle, so right. Per the European directive. So that's what I thought it was. And then I come over here and they tell me that it's a motorhome. But when you look at their own specifications, it doesn't qualify as a motorhome. Because motorhomes and motorhomes get cheaper insurance and tax.
So could you not go into Derry and reclassify that vehicle as not a camper van and then go back to them? I know it's a whole hassle, don't get me wrong, but I mean, you have access to the UK nearby, in inverted commas. You can't go into the office or whatever it might be there and get it right. Okay.
Because I live here.
Oh, yes.
And they said that if it's a N1 van, it will cost me €200 VRT.
Mm.
But because it's, if it's a camper van, it will cost me €900.
Which is significant,
Which I don't have. I've just relocated here.
Yeah. That's understandable. You don't have to explain that. Yeah. No, I get you. Most of us don't have €700 extra lying around the place. So you actually got the advice to flog it, to sell it in England or UK.
Yeah, she said an option is export it back to the UK, sell it, come back and get an Irish vehicle.
Mm.
And then she said to me, because I'm going to have a problem getting it insured as well because it's a primary vehicle, not a leisure vehicle.
Yes.
And she said to me, well, it doesn't matter, just insure it as an N1 vehicle, which is under-insuring it. So I'm getting this random advice that just doesn't make any sense. And
so this is not as simple as you selling this car in the north, is it? No, it's already the process would have to be reversed. So this has already been transferred to some extent. Now it's a case of getting it through VRT and getting okay.
Yeah, yeah.
What did the guard say to you when you turned yourself in?
Oh, they didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to do with me. So the nice young man on the desk said he'd refer it to a travel cop who would get back to me, who hasn't yet. But I chased yesterday because when I come to work, I see these checkpoints on the roads every now and then where they're checking. You know, when I see stories about vehicles getting seized, and I don't want to be breaking the law.
No, look, Johanna, it's clear that all you want to be is compliant. But what's happening is the system is working against you. So I'm just trying to fully establish the problems so that someone out there can listen. So the problem is they can only presumably register it here like for like. So if this is an M1 vehicle in Britain and Northern Ireland, they would have to then presumably register it here in an equivalent category, presumably.
I've got no idea. I assume so because they're the EU classification. But she said it's different in Ireland. But then on the VRT website, it refers you to the EU directive. So I've been researching this for days and hours, and I've got no idea how it works. I don't know where they've got this €900 figure from. I can't talk to the person that's decided this.
Right. Okay.
Listen,
there's people do this all the time.
Someone's
bound to give us some advice. Johanna, I must ask, and my tongue is in my cheek, you were over in Britain for the Brexit vote. Please tell me you voted no, because this is all because of Brexit.
Absolutely. Well, no, unfortunately, I mean, this isn't because of Brexit.
I don't know. I think it's gotten worse, yeah. Okay, and as
yeah,
I say,
oh,
don't
I absolutely didn't vote for it. But I've heard, you know, one way that I've bonded and got to know people in Donegal, because I didn't know anybody here, is chatting to local people about VRT, because it's not just me. And a lot of people don't know the rules. So I was talking to a young lad who worked, went to get my tyres checked in a local place. And he said to me that he just, for his first car, he got a little car, it wasn't very expensive, and he didn't know the rules. It was an export, and he ended up paying €10,000. And he said it was the worst decision he'd made, because he didn't have that kind of money. And a lot of people are having similar issues. So it's not just me. And if you look on forums, when you Google it, there's lots of people that are trying to figure it out.
It's a big issue.
Know how it works.
Okay, Johanna, listen, leave it with us, because, you know, there's cases ongoing at the moment where Revenue applied their own rules in relation to import cars incorrectly. You know, there's a complex area here, and it's one that's been covered over the years. But this isn't one instance in your instance. You just want a little bit of advice, a little bit of help as to how you can be fully complicit with the law as you want to be. Okay, Johanna, listen, I won't delay you from work any longer. I do appreciate you
can
stepping out
add,
and chatting to us.
Can
of course
I just
you can.
Add, sorry.
Go ahead.
The first time I went to the VRT place and they told me to get an engineer's report on the seat, they didn't tell me to get a report on the rest of it.
Yeah.
And so it almost feels like it's intentionally obstructive. So
I did what
they asked. I've done everything that they asked. It's now 2024. I got here and they charge you if you don't get it done within the 30 days of arriving, but they make it impossible to do so. If they'd have told me in the first place what I needed to do, I'd have done it. But I just say to them, I'm not doing anything else, because whatever I do, I go back and I just keep getting sent away again.
Yeah.
And I can't insure the vehicle because it's not registered.
Can you decamp it? Can you get the bed and all out the back of it?
Well, I could, but then I'd have to take it back to get it
reevaluated again.
Inspected
okay.
again.
Maybe you should just take it over as a camper van then. Just do it as a camper van.
The difficulty is the insurance, because I don't use it as a leisure vehicle. I use it as a daily. It's my only vehicle.
Okay. Right. Okay.
And so getting that insured is really difficult.
Right. Okay. So hopefully now we've enough info there.
Conform.
We've enough info. Did the insurance company accept your no claims bonus out of interest?
I've not even been able to try that yet.
Okay,
because,
I get you. No problem.
I can't get insurance until I've registered it.
Jinx and reels, okay.
Because they want the Irish plates. Yeah.
What a nightmare.
Yeah. People have suggested that I move to Northern Ireland until I've got it registered.
Hardly.
And commute to work.
No,
because,
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, I think that's an extreme. We'll have to come up with a solution between you moving country. Effectively, in terms of the situation we're in at the moment. Okay, Johanna, listen, thank you for that. Hopefully someone's picked enough out of that
thank
that can come up with some sort of a solution. Slán, thank you. Johanna there. Great help. If you have any help, 0860 25000, 0749 125000. By the way, lately we've seen a huge spike in interactions with the programme. We've always been really busy, genuinely. Don't just say that. Lots of programmes, maybe they do or don't, I don't know. But we have an amazing level of interaction with our listeners, because we're all part of the one family and I hope we're all friends. But lately too, we're seeing more of you emailing in, which is, so you can go into things with a little bit more detail. And all of the emails are read, by the way, and we chase up everything as much as we can. But I just wanted to say thank you for taking the time to keep us updated and let us know where we can help you and things like that. So very much appreciated. Let's do a nice one here. They're all nice, you know what I mean. Hi, producer of Greg's 9 till Noon show. I would like to send anonymous praise for the ED department at Letterkenny General Hospital, as it seems always to be negative comments. I arrived with my 82-year-old mother last night at around 8 p.m. after a very prompt service from NowDoc, who asked me did I require an ambulance. Luckily, I could drive and felt she was stable enough to go in my car. NowDoc sent a fax to inform ED that we were on the way, which was very helpful. On arrival, we were triaged very quickly by very friendly, attentive staff, then had an ECG done by the lovely Anna, who reassured us that although There would be a bit of a wait because there were ambulances backed up outside the door. We would be seen as soon as possible. We were fortunate to be given a seat, stroke wheelchair, inside the doors right at the main hub of the department. To say that every staff member was busy is such an understatement. No one realised this on the other side of the doors. We were kept informed where we were in priority, but unfortunately, as always happens to the ambulances, they're still coming in the back door, unknown to all on the seats inside the emergency department. Not once in the entire time we were there did we see one person stop for hardly even water. However, at approximately 12:45 / 1 a.m, the lovely nurse Anna and a male colleague passed through the whole ED inside and outside the doors with tea, toasts and sandwiches for everyone. I just want to show our appreciation for their hard work and going above and beyond. Not all heroes wear capes. If Greg could maybe just read this out for me, no problem. Happy to do so. And I hope it doesn't get lost in... I hope it doesn't get lost in the commentary that we do have from time to time as it relates to the hospital, is the reason we would give so much time to it and platform issues is always with the staff in mind and to support the staff. Because as you say, when you're in the ED, sometimes you don't see what's going on behind the doors, and there are people going from X-ray to the resus to here, there and everywhere. They're flying around and they're really, really busy. And I know enough of the staff down there and have... off-air contact with enough of them to realise that hopefully they see that we do appreciate everything they do in very difficult conditions. Obviously, some people are going to have negative experiences. I get that too. But that we're actually seeking more funding, more investment to support the brilliant work they do and to retain them there. And it's never a criticism, very rarely a criticism of staff. But it's lovely to have that text in and to emphasise all of that. We received this email... I want to highlight an issue which I now believe is common practice in Donegal, and this is refusals by landlords' agents to return rental deposits when students are leaving rented accommodation. My daughter and friends had a 12-month arrangement in their rented property. They left the property as agreed in December, and my husband and I oversaw the cleaning out of the property and the removal of all rubbish, and the house was left in better condition than when they moved in. But the landlord refused to return their substantial deposit because he didn't get written notice that they were moving out, even though they had it in writing from the agent that they had to move out in December. When this was challenged, they were then told that there was cleaning issues, which is also untrue because I've got photographic evidence and videos of all the rooms which were properly cleaned when keys were returned. This is only taking advantage of students who comply with the rules and do everything by the book. Landlords are letting agents and letting agency fabricating reasons to retain the deposit. I'm obviously taking this matter down a legal route, but it's unfair and is giving all landlords a bad name and is a poor reflection on Donegal. And I'll be contacting Letterkenny University Hospital, National University of Galway, and ensuring their students don't use this landlord for the letting agent in the future. Thanks and regards. Okay, so we stuck that up on our socials, and Rachel's a former landlord and joins us on the programme now. Rachel, thanks so much for your time. I know you're very, very busy. So what is your reaction to that?
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm good, Rachel. What's your reaction to that listener statement?
Yeah, I'm just speaking on behalf of the private landlord who just has one house, not the man with the multi properties. I had a house in Sligo that I wound up selling in 2019. I had it for 10 years and I rented it out to students in the Glencairn region, which would be well-known student area in Sligo. And anybody that knows me would know that that house was left handed over to students in immaculate condition. And 9 times out of 10, every time I got the keys back in May or April or May when they were leaving, the house was just absolutely wrecked or in bad condition or just dirty. But personally, I never kept the deposits on the students because my take on it was that I just wanted them gone. I wanted them out of the house, off my doorstep. I was afraid that they could come back and damage the property because I'm not living in the house. I live up in Letterkenny, so it's a good drive for me to go up and down between Sligo. So that was my take on it. So I've read what the lady has wrote up, and I mean, I think it's terrible that the landlord has kept the deposit if they've gone in and cleaned the house better than what it was. I can honestly say that no parent of the students that I rented ever came in and cleaned the house. They would be there on the first day in September to get their kids settled, but there'd be no sign of those parents when I'd be getting the keys back in May when the house was upside down.
But in terms of this landlord, is it in their, for the amount of money what maybe we're talking, is it in their interest really to hold on to it, maybe have their reputation damaged? Maybe they are money grabbers, I don't know, but Would you say that's the exception or the rule? Now, I know you were a private sort of single property landlord, but what would you hear on the grapevine about how landlords treated students?
Just to point out, I've been on the both sides. I've been the landlord and I've been the tenant. And I've had my deposits held back whenever I was younger too, on siblings of mine for it'd be the same issue, saying that the place wasn't clean and it wouldn't, you know, it would be cleaner than whenever we would have gotten, this sort of a thing, you know. But like, I can't really talk on behalf of anybody.
I get you.
I don't know the person.
More generally, though, Rachel, I mean, obviously you exited it now because of all the hassle and electricity bills being skipped and all that kind of stuff. And also, too, it seems more so in the last couple of words that landlord has become a dirty word. You know what I mean? It's almost like an insult.
I think that we get a bad rep that, you know, people have to remember, like the single house owner like me, I was up working full-time in Letterkenny. I'm paying rent to somebody else up in Letterkenny, a fantastic landlord that I had for 6 or 7 years. He was wonderful. But, you know, if I could live in the house in Sligo, I would have. But it's just my job took me up to Letterkenny. And, you know, I had to pay insurance. I had to work hard to buy the house, number one. I had to pay insurance in the house. I had to pay local property tax in the house. And I think people forget that. They think that, like, people are wealthy, that everybody that owns a house for rent is so rich and that we are just money grabbers. But, like, I'm just the average woman on the street, like the average man on the street. I'm just renting that house to pay the rent up in Letterkenny, basically. But the house was totally and absolutely abused 9 times out of 10.
Yeah, do you think, though, some landlords do sort of see, though, renting out as a way of paying down the mortgage for free or covering other bills that they have people in the house paying down their mortgage to a great extent for them. So there is something in it for the landlord. I mean, maybe you don't take any profit out of it, but you are sort of writing down your debt by renting it out to other people. Not you. I mean you in a generic sense, yeah. Rachel.
I would say the long-term person that's renting the house, because mine was only short term, so you're talking September to May. And sometimes the student might leave in December because they realise they don't like the course they're doing. So then I'd be stuck with a room then trying to fill that in January, basically. Mm. But maybe the person rented it long term, but that was the problem for me, that it was short term. And like, I couldn't put ESB bills into students' names because at the time it was €250 to change the name. And no student was going to pay $250, and you'd be changing that twice a year. So you'd be putting in their name September and then kind of changing it back to my name then in May. So that's how, I was kind of...
And I suppose too, finally, Rachel, I won't hold you, but I mean, you know, like, it's different maybe in the case of our emailer, but generally speaking, you know, maybe parents, even though sometimes the children are 18, 19 or 20, they're sending them into someone else's property and they're not respecting it as perhaps they should. Maybe we as parents and guardians and what have you, caregivers, need to be educating our young people to be a bit more respectful of other people's property.
Definitely, yeah. Like I said, the parents would be there on the 1st of September with the child, showing them into the property. Bye-bye, see you next weekend. And you'd not, there'd be no sign of them and those kids are moving out in April or May.
Okay, Rachel. Thanks very much for your time. I do appreciate it. That's Rachel there. Okie doke. Now, some of your comments coming in as it relates to Johanna. Tell that lady to look up Camper Vibe on Facebook and YouTube. They're bringing a self-built camper from the UK to Ireland. They might have advice. I don't think she wants to bring a camper in. Tell that woman to go around the back street garages. They can put her in the right direction. Not much they don't know. I'm not sure if that's a compliment or otherwise. Just to say, we were in the A&E last week, sat for 10 hours with a young child. It was terrible. Had to stand for 2 hours. There was no room anywhere. Children were offered nothing, not even a drink. Hi, Greg. I have a house coming up for rent shortly, but was told last night that I have to be a registered landlord before 2021 before I can rent to a mica victim. Can any of your listeners clarify this? Much appreciated. Okay, so this is a person with a house coming up for rent. They are inclined to rent it to someone who's affected by defective concrete, but they have to be registered as a landlord before 2021 before they can. Now, is that based on the scheme, the scheme paying rent? Surely that is a serious issue if that is the case there. Listening to the lady re-registering the car, haven't done it recently. Safe Home Ireland are a great resource and of advice. Safe Home Ireland. Okay, thank you for that. Greg, of course, the Irish government is not going to do anything for the people of Gaza because they're just puppets for the Americans and British warmongers. I would say that they have been perhaps, you know, out of step a little bit. But anyway, Dr. Kieran O'Farrell is joining us on the programme now, local GP. Thanks, Kieran, for your time. I do really appreciate it, and good morning to you.
Morning, Greg. Good morning to your listeners.
Again, we're going to talk about winter surges, and I get that, but we get appeals even in the summer, in August now, from the hospital to stay away unless absolutely necessary. But generally speaking, this is a tough time for most acute hospitals around the country.
Yes, it is. And, you know, you've seen a lot of media coverage over the last few days of difficulties in emergency departments and hospitals throughout the country. We expect January to be a challenging month with surges in influenza and COVID and RSV and other respiratory illnesses. So we do know that it is particularly challenging at the moment. But I suppose beyond that, as you said, we know that there are ongoing challenges with access to care in hospitals and emergency departments. And these kind of warnings and pleas to stay away are far from unique to January.
And looking at the figures, it's clear that the problem is not just simply, you know, more staff in ED, quick triage and getting people. You know, we've got 21 on trolleys. There's 25 in the surge capacity, but there are 24 in hospital beds as delayed discharges, i.e., and correct me if I'm wrong, Kieran, you know, they are well enough now to leave the acute hospital setting, but for a number of reasons, they can't be discharged.
Yes, those figures on delayed discharges are generally people who are fit to go but may need other care in other places. So they may be waiting for home care packages or a bed in a community hospital. And we know that there are difficulties accessing those kind of care. So in my area here in East Donegal, there are difficulties with home care packages and getting access to those in a timely fashion. And we know there's difficulties with access to community beds. For us as GPs, we have a severe lack of access to acute kind of beds in the community. We know things like Lifford Community Hospital is out of action at the moment with that lack of beds. So access to beds in the community is a challenge, and then that has a knock-on effect within the hospital as well.
Particularly sort of focusing on East Donegal, St. Joseph's being used as sort of like the default step-down care, if I'm phrasing that correctly. Has that complicated it for the likes of yourself in East Donegal?
I suppose the fact that we've lost the capacity in Lifford Hospital has definitely made it more challenging. And so there are less community beds available in the area because of that. So there's difficulty accessing those beds because there are less of them. So I suppose for us as GPs, we have been advocating for more access to community beds. There are patients that we sometimes have to send to the emergency department for admission because there is no other alternative to them where they would be better suited to a bed in a community hospital. But unfortunately, that capacity isn't there.
And the issues at the hospital and GP's concerns are well established at this point, and I'm not sure we've seen any progress in that regard just as of yet. But just in relation to home care packages, step-down care, supports for families or in the home, which are the home care packages, of course, that I'm referencing, what needs to be done? Because I presume more of that capacity is needed. In other words, that capacity grows faster than it would shrink. So this is going in one direction. There's always going to be an increase in demand, presumably. Do you have an insight on what we need to be doing or how we could resolve that issue?
I don't have the specifics on what the challenges are, but as far as I know, the challenges was recruiting and having enough staff available to provide those home care packages. And so, you know, if you don't have enough staff to provide them, obviously that's going to delay people getting access to them. We know that our population is getting older, that there are more chronic diseases out there. And so this shift towards community care is going to have to put more focus on the availability of home care packages. So we need more people in those jobs. You know, those working in them would argue that the terms and conditions make them not desirable and difficult for people to continue in them. And so anybody who has a home care package will tell you how valuable they find it and how useful it is and how much it does keep people in their homes. But I think the issue there is again, capacity and availability of staff to provide those services.
Yeah, it is worrying. Do you believe that we are through a peak yet in terms of respiratory issues, be it RSV, COVID or the flu for that matter?
Well, I suppose if we look at the Health Protection Surveillance Centre figures, it looks like we are past the peak. So cases of COVID, influenza and RSV have all fallen over the last 2 to 3 weeks. They're still at significantly high levels, particularly influenza, but they are falling. And so you would hope that that does mean that we're beyond the peak, but still, I suppose, a significant knock-on effect in terms of presentations over the next number of weeks.
Yeah, for sure. And we the traditional respite then perhaps is not there because the hospital is running over capacity. It almost seems all year round at this stage. So the fundamental problems we're talking about now need addressing because throughout the year, it's not just a winter thing anymore.
No. And when you talk about the 25 patients today in surge capacity, that means they're in places like day services or other services that then can't operate because they're full. So that again has a knock-on effect. So it's a vicious circle. And, you know, there is huge healthcare demand. Just looking at the figures in my own surgery here today, we've over 200 appointments scheduled in the surgery here today, a mixture of acute care, routine care and chronic care. So, the demand is always huge throughout the year, and it's always difficult to manage. And, you know, the system is doing its best, but there isn't enough capacity out there to deal with the demand that's there.
Yeah, OK. Really interesting, actually, to get that sort of figure in from one GP practice, albeit a big one, but still, that's a lot of people. Okay, thank you very much, Doctor. I do appreciate your time. Take care of yourself. That's Dr. Kieran O'Farrey there talking about hospital crowding. Just to recap those figures, his own practice there, over 200 appointments today alone. 21 people on trolleys at Letterkenny University Hospital. There's 25 in surge capacities in overflow areas. In having an impact then in daycare stuff, it's having an impact on other elements of the hospital. And there's 24 people sitting down there in the hospital who are able to go home effectively. Sorry, I must phrase that correctly. They're fit to leave the acute hospital setting, but they're delayed for numerous reasons. Maybe family can't receive them at the moment, which is something that was mentioned before. Home care packages, places in community hospitals. So that's 24 people and 24 mums, dads, sons, daughters, aunts, uncles, by multiple, all concerned and worried about them, hoping that their loved one gets better as soon as is possible, gets into a space where they can continue the recovery as soon as is possible. To the front of the Tyrconnell Tribune now, and we are going to talk to Deputy Sinn Féin Deputy Padraig McLaughlin about Milford School. And I suppose before getting to that, good morning to you, Padraig.
Good morning, Greg.
Before getting to your meeting with the Minister, maybe you could outline to us sort of really what you already know and what came from the public meeting with parents in Milford. Read the concerns about the school.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Yeah, no, I had myself and the Sinn Féin representative Maria Doherty had organised a public meeting in Milford Town. We would do these across the area. And at the meeting in Milford Town, just there in mid-December, parents of children at Scolwyra there in Milford, the National School, came to the meeting and outlined their very serious concerns around the school. On the back of that, I had offered to go to the school the next morning and at very short notice, and I really appreciated it, the principal, of the school, and indeed the board of management, Chairman Farver Gorman, and a number of the parents took me around the school. And I've been a public rep for a long time, Greg. I've been to a lot of schools and I've seen a lot of issues, but I really was genuinely shocked.
What jumped out at you?
Well, it's just a totally cramped amenities. It was built in the late 1950s for a totally different time. None of the classrooms would be up to the standard of Department of Education guidelines, the corridors. The toilets are totally inappropriate. There's no proper sewage system in the toilets. The play amenities are just totally...
What about pick up and drop off? Is that a...
Yeah, there's also road safety, big road safety issues there, Greg, because of the location. I mean, you're going up into a number of secondary schools, all bottlenecked along with the national school. You have a very busy road running alongside one of the main arteries in the Milford area.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for the Donegal County Council and indeed the Garda superintendents, everybody has said this is a very questionable location. So in every level you look at, Greg, now the one thing I do want to point out was, and it was totally obvious to me, like the dedication of the principal, of the teachers, I mean, all the parents, I mean, the level of education is absolutely exceptional at the school.
Well, listen, but the facilities aren't. That's a sign of its success, 220 pupils and growing. Now, we've talked about schools in the past on this programme, and one of the issues often is you know, maybe the current site's not fit for redevelopment. I would imagine that's the case here. Or there's not an alternative. You know, and we will get on to your minister with your meeting with the minister in a moment. But that is one problem that doesn't necessarily exist here, because a greenfield site is there, effectively, isn't it? What's the status of that site?
Yeah, I mean, they've looked at it, and it'd be much more cost effective to build a new school to modern standards, you know, to give the children the best education possible. And they have in the community identified a location within the control points of the town. And they have been interacting with the landowner and indeed some of the local councillors have looked at the issue of planning. You know, so I think everything can be done, but time is of the essence. And indeed, the message I got from the principal and from, you know, the board of management and the parents was that, you know, right now, if they had hope, you know, if they knew that a new school was on the way, that it was on the capital programme going through the process, they could knuckle down. But right now it's the lack of hope that things are going to change, that they have patchwork sort of things going on around site.
Well, then let's get to that meeting with the minister. Did Minister Foley give any hope?
Yeah, well, I had submitted a parliamentary question, Greg, and the first response, you know, usually drafted
generic by
department officials, I wasn't happy with it. I submitted a follow-up because I'm very conscious that Minister Foley had visited the school, has seen for herself in recent times how bad the conditions are at the school, and she personally understands that. So I thought, right, I'm going to go and I put another parliamentary question, but I'm going to have to meet her face to face. So I met her yesterday and we discussed the matter. I reminded her, like, she'd been to the school. I took her through all the problems at the school. She asked me, is there an alternative site? And I said, yes, in the community, I understand, but time would be of the essence. I also let her know that the school board of management have organized a briefing for local public representatives on Friday, the 9th of February. And, you know, it would be very useful if we had an update by then. And, you know, I'd asked her to engage with her local colleagues, you know, government representatives, councillors and TDs in the county, just to verify all of the points I'm making, because this will be a team effort. So I found her receptive, and she didn't make any commitments, but she said she would discuss this with her colleagues in the county and try to give us an update.
So how does this work? I mean, does the school submit an application for a new build? Is that how this normally works? Have they done that? Does the Department of Education invite proposals? Like, from here going forward, how does one get the ball rolling on a completely new build of a school?
Yeah, it seems that the department, I suppose the government too, moved the goalposts a number of years ago in terms of new schools. You know, this is a school capital buildings programme, it's called. And they were focusing on the big cities, the kind of commuter belts, those areas with big population, to the disadvantage of the likes of Donegal and similar counties. And instead, what we're getting is sort of, you know, sort of prefabs and add-ons and, you know, patch-up jobs. And, you know, I think that's, you have to fight them on this and you have to challenge them. Now, it's for, to the credit of the school that they manage and the local public representatives that they got Minister Foley to visit the school. It's really important that the minister sees it with her own eyes. So she can be in no doubt as to what the situation is there. So what we need to do now is, you know, say that we can't accept, you know, the patch up work. We need to have a date. We need it on the capital programme. And we need to give hope that there's going to be in the near future a school that befits the teachers. I mean, I from talking to the parents in the community and from seeing for myself the parents that day and the principal, like, you know, I'm just going to say this, the principal did work beyond the call of duty and her family. There was a basement below the school, you know, storage area converted into a classroom. They did that of their own time. Like, the level of commitment is incredible. Mm. But you can't take people for granted. They need hope that it's going to get better, and I think they deserve that.
All right, well, let's keep our fingers crossed. Thank you very much for that. That's Sinn Féin Deputy Padraig McLaughlin on the new school there. And it's if you're affected by that, i.e. you work there, maybe the principal's listening, or you're a parent there, you can lend your voice to it ahead of that meeting, to that campaign. You can lend your voice to it ahead of that meeting, which is scheduled for the 9th of February, I believe we were told there. Please, Greg, tell Greg you no longer get a medical card at 70. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't realise that. I rented a room in a house with shared bills. The bills kept getting higher. When I asked for the actual paper proof of the bills, surprise, surprise, they were not in fact that amount. The letting agent made an excuse that he had so many, it was a simple mistake. Then I discovered that two of the rooms rented via the owner were in fact €100 cheaper than the two via the letting agent. Be very wary of agents. Okay, it doesn't sound ideal by any stretch of the imagination. Good morning, Greg. The situation here in Donegal is that Irish Water are responsible for the hydrants, but the fire hydrant is a key piece of equipment in a firefighter's arsenal. And in my opinion, all fire stations should be responsible for the servicing annually of all hydrants in their respective areas. This would also help at building familiarity for the firefighters of the location of fire hydrants. Okay, that's not a bad idea, I suppose. Leona, who was on with us earlier on, she's wrong about print. Both print and digital are big. Look at all the worldwide tabloids still in print as well as digital. It's not, that wasn't coming from Leona. We had the head of one of the biggest news groups that cover Britain and Ireland. They have the Irish Independent, the Sunday Independent, and a few other papers. It was he that said, look, there's no future for papers. That's not me saying it. He said, and he runs a paper. He says, there's no future for papers at the moment. It's the revenue 70% paper, sold papers. There and 30% digital. He says there'll be no daily papers coming from their paper group in 2030, 2033. He's not really quite sure of the date. No, unequivocal. He didn't say, oh, well, we'll try. The bottom line is there's not going to be any papers published by them on a daily basis. Also, they're trying to get rid of the older journalists. There's 50 voluntary redundancies. People can get stuck in their ways. You know, the future is digital. That's the bottom line. And if you don't see that, well then, you know, maybe that's one of the 50 that they're trying to get shot of in the Irish Independent. Because of course, you know, you do certain things a certain way for a certain amount of time. It can be hard to switch to the inevitable. I'm sure it's right across the board. Everyone's having to do it in the media. It's not exclusive to newspapers. So it's not the owner's point of view. It's actually the owner of one of the biggest circulating newspapers. But then you look at the Farmers Journal, and they knock it out of the park every single week. They're selling, what is it, over 300,000 copies. And it's thick, and it's quality, and it's stories, and it's interviews, and it's progressing stories, it's great in stories. Maybe that's the future, I don't know. It's not an area I work in or have any understanding of. I just know from the people that run the big papers, that is what they've been saying. Hey, have a wonderful Thursday, will you? We are going to disembark the 9 till noon show train now, and getting on board is your pilot, your train driver, John Breslin, around the Northwest throughout the weekend. We're back tomorrow at 9 with our Friday panel. If you want to suggest a topic for conversation, feel free to text us 086 60 25,000, and so much more throughout the course of Friday's 9 till noon show. Have a wonderful day today, though. So for me, Greg Hughes, Karen Anore, who researched and produced the show, and Sharon Wilkes, who's working away. Wilkins? No, I had it right in my head. I'm sorry, Shannon. Shannon, Do you want to say it in my ear, Caroline? No, Sharon. Yeah, second name. Wilkin, that's what I said. Okay, Sharon Wilkin. Have a great day.